From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. Over the last few months, both in the U.S. and abroad, we've seen the devastating effects natural disasters have on public health. On today's show, we'll raise the question of just how natural events such as floods, droughts, and powerful hurricanes are, and whether human activities could be modified to moderate the impacts of these disasters on public health and safety. Brenda Eck-Wurzel and Doug Boucher are joining us to address this question of how natural are natural disasters. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On September 1st, the state of Missouri began requiring families to pay a monthly premium for their children to remain in the state's insurance program that expands health insurance coverage to children in low-income families. Missouri recently issued a report on the consequences of that premium. Auditors found that only 49% of the families that had children enrolled in the insurance program paid the premium. The result was that 21,500 children have lost their health insurance coverage. Depending on total family income, the premiums varied from 1 to 5% of annual income. Officials in the state have not yet indicated any intent to reverse the policy change. The report is available at the website of the Kaiser Family Foundation, kaisernetwork.org. More than 500,000 women worldwide died from complications related to pregnancy or childbirth in the year 2000, and 99% of those maternal deaths were preventable, according to a report recently issued by the UN Population Fund. Complications of pregnancy and HIV are the leading cause of death among women ages 15 to 44. The report estimated that 76 million pregnancies occur worldwide, which were not planned or desired by the couple, but the couple lacked access to contraceptive care. On the issue of abortion, the UN Population Fund estimates that 19 million unsafe abortions occur worldwide annually. The report also noted that women are increasingly accounting for the predominance of HIV-infected individuals. This is an especially great problem among women ages 15 to 24. In that age group, women are 60% more likely to be HIV-positive than men of the same age. The report predicts that countries that improve gender equality and invest in the health and education of women and youth would find that over subsequent years, they'd suffer lower rates of HIV prevalence and have smaller families with healthier, more literate children. Also, last month, the Bush administration announced that it would continue its policy of providing no aid whatever to the UN Population Fund. That UN agency provides reproductive health services to women in the poor countries across the globe. The U.S. objection relates to coercive contraceptive policies in China, with which the UN Population Fund has no role. The report on mortality among women is available at the website of the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA.org. Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada, Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty, and the president of Toyota Motor Corporation, Katsuaki Watanabe, officially broke ground last week for a Toyota assembly plant in a southwestern Ontario city. The decision by the automaker to place a new plant in Canada continues a current trend of the auto industry to close plants in the U.S. in favor of Canada and other nations. Though several state governments in the U.S. offered tax subsidies double what Ontario was offering, Toyota made the decision to locate in Ontario for two primary reasons. One is the superior educational level of the workers in Canada compared to most U.S. states. And the other was health costs. Canadian workers are $4 to $5 per hour cheaper to employ, thanks to the taxpayer-funded healthcare system in Canada. David Emerson, the Canadian Minister of Industry, noted that people are beginning to look upon the Canadian healthcare system as a competitive advantage. The report is available at the website of the Canadian Broadcasting Company, cbc.ca. The United States Food and Drug Administration's warnings to drug companies over misleading advertisements have more than tripled in the last year. The agency sent 17 warning letters in the 12 months ending in August 2005, compared with an average of about 4 to 5 letters in previous years. The majority of the 17 letters, over 80%, cited companies for not including information about side effects and other risks in promotional materials designed for patients or doctors. Many offending ads left out certain risks, while others used very small font size to mention them at the bottom of the page. About half the letters also warned companies for making false claims about how well the drug worked, while about 40% were citations for wrongly comparing the featured drug to a competitor. The report is available at the website of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA.gov. Coming up next, a look at natural disasters which have had such a great impact on public health. The question is, how natural are they? So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In the July 2001 airing of Public Health Radio, air pollution was the major focus of the show. We discussed the fact that combustion products, including sulfur dioxides, nitrogen oxides, ozone, and particulates, can all cause lung disease and probably heart disease as well. Conspicuously absent from that discussion was carbon dioxide, even though it's by far the major product of combustion in almost all situations. We ignored carbon dioxide in that show because unless airborne concentrations are far higher than anything we're likely to see, carbon dioxide has no direct toxic effect on humans. But the small, steady increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration noted over the last century are beginning to have noticeable, even dramatic effects on climate. Most of the hottest summers of the last 100 years occurred after 1990. The polar ice caps are melting, and ocean temperatures have been steadily rising. These rising ocean temperatures provide the thermal fuel for tropical storms. And the ferocity of tropical storms and cyclones has been increasing. Even though 2004 was a devastating year for hurricanes in the United States, especially in Florida, with Hurricane Katrina in early September of this year, many Americans began asking if the apparently increasing severity of hurricanes was in fact a completely natural event, or could there be an important human element causing these severe hurricanes. In both the U.S. and abroad, other seemingly natural disasters are increasing in frequency and severity as well. These include drought, wildfires, and floods. And the liberation of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere are not the only human activity that provokes or augments natural disasters. Our patterns of development, wetland management, and especially deforestation all have impacts. The public health significance of these natural disasters became especially clear with Hurricane Katrina. Several hundred people died, thousands developed intestinal infections due to unsafe water supplies and sewage contamination. Toxic sludge entered the houses of many people in New Orleans, and a number of individuals suffered from dehydration and exposure after they became homeless. Furthermore, ill individuals lost access to pharmacies for critical medications, and hundreds of thousands of ill and injured individuals temporarily lost access to medical care. And then there are frequent mental health consequences of natural disasters: flashbacks of reliving the event, depression, and anxiety, the syndrome known as post-traumatic stress disorder. So the public health impacts of what are called natural disasters are numerous. In large disasters in any country, and in even much smaller disasters in the poorer countries, these adverse consequences on public health are regular, predictable features. So it's likely that over the next century, the overall health impacts of environmental transformation leading to droughts, floods, and powerful storms are likely to be far greater than the impacts of the conventionally studied air pollutants we discussed 4 years ago on Public Health Radio. So on today's show, we'll look at the question, just how natural are these natural disasters? And are there steps we can take to slow down these human impacts that are leading to a future with an even greater number of such disasters? Joining us today for the discussion are Brenda Ekwurzel and Doug Boucher. Brenda Ekwurzel is a geoscientist with expertise and numerous publications in the areas of oceanography, hydrology, and climate science. She currently leads the climate science team at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Doug Boucher is an associate professor of biology at Hood College in Maryland. His area of specialty and research effort include plant and forest ecology and natural resources management. Brenda Ekwurzel and Doug Boucher, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'd like to start out the discussion by talking about hurricanes, and in particular, Katrina. When you look at the damage from Hurricane Katrina, is this a truly natural disaster, or are there, in fact, significant contributions of human activity on this type of very devastating weather event?
I guess I'll start. I think it's clearly a natural disaster in the sense that, we wouldn't have had the enormous destruction had it not been for the hurricane coming out of the Gulf, and we didn't create the hurricane. On the other hand, as with many, many natural disasters, the destruction was made much, much greater by human activity, ranging from what's happening on the local scale with, for example, building along the coast, the design of levees in New Orleans, and the prevention of the normal mitigation processes of the floodplain, to the global scale, where global warming increasingly seems to be causing hurricanes to be stronger, to increasing the intensity of hurricanes. So it's, as with a lot of so-called natural disasters, yes, it's natural, but it's also deeply affected by human beings.
Well, let's go through some of those perhaps in a little bit more detail. You talked about the mitigation of some natural processes locally. I presume that has to do with how the coastline is being engineered. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit.
Sure. Well, there are really two sorts of things. The destruction, especially in the Mississippi and Alabama coasts, has a lot to do with the fact that we've been building on barrier islands. And barrier islands tend to move around. They tend to erode on one side and sand gets deposited on the other side. They move up and down the coast. They're constantly changing where they are. And when we build cities on them, when we build resorts, vacation homes, hotels, we try to stop that. We put in breakwaters. We do these beach renourishment plans where the Corps of Engineers, for example, dredges up enormous amounts of sand offshore and keeps on depositing it on the beach. But what that does, of course, is it puts those communities in a very, very vulnerable position for hurricanes. It means that they're right on the barrier island is the normal sort of protection, the first line that slows down the destruction of hurricanes. And if you've built on it, the people who are out there on the barrier islands really get the brunt of the storm.
So those barrier islands would be mitigating the storm surge. Is that the idea?
Yes, and they would be a place that where the sand could move around and would move around without doing a lot of destruction. But of course, if we're building out there and people are living out there and have homes out there, there is enormous destruction when the hurricane hits.
And then there's also apparently an issue with the coastline of Louisiana having actually, they've apparently lost 20 miles of coastline of Louisiana due to the canal development. Is this true?
Yeah, the system of levees and dredging and the channel of the Mississippi River prevents the normal process of floodplain creation and renourishment, which generally happens every year, especially in the spring, when sediment overflows the banks of the river and deposits on the floodplain. And that's what keeps the floodplain there, keeps the floodplain fairly high, even though it's losing land to erosion. That land gets recreated every year. But when we put in things like levees, we basically make sure that renourishment can't happen. And so as the coastal wetlands, the marshes, the swamps erode away, nothing replaces them. And so the shoreline actually creeps inward, and in the case of Louisiana, very, very, very substantially.
The state is actually 20 miles smaller, right all the way along the coast, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's actually had its coastline move inland by that amount over the years. And of course, that's also affected by global warming, because it means that sea level is also rising. Global warming tends to melt the polar ice caps. That increases the amount of water in the oceans, and so the sea level comes up.
Well, let's get more into the issue of global warming. What are the impacts of global warming on, the frequency or the intensity and power that storms and hurricanes are likely to develop?
Well, when we look worldwide, the number of storms that are spawning in the tropics tends to be the same if you add up all over the world. What we have seen is there have been some major publications and studies that show that, in essence, over the past 30 years, we've seen an increase in the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes. In other words, global warming is not only causing sea level to rise due to warmth of the water and the melting of ice, but we also see that the warmer waters are fueling stronger storms, much like gasoline fuels a fire. And so for coastal residents, that's really a double whammy. You have even regular storms penetrating further inland on this higher sea level rise. So if you've designed a levee 40, 50 years ago, it may not be taking into account the steady rise of sea level and the increasing power of these storms.
Hence, greater destruction than otherwise would be the case.
In particular, since more and more of our population is choosing to live right near that dynamic interface between the land and the sea.
What other impacts, meteorological impacts, is global warming predicted to have or might have in the future in terms of storms that might affect, say, colder regions of the world or say, the tropics? Is that known? Are there reliable meteorological models that can predict that?
Well, we do see evidence with these tropical storms that you need at least 80 degrees Fahrenheit water for a hurricane in the Atlantic or a typhoon in the Pacific or a cyclone in the Indian Ocean to thrive. So we do see the direct effect of global warming on those ocean temperatures. We also see farther afield that the Arctic sea ice has retreated dramatically over the past 50 years. And we also see that frozen peatlands in Alaska and Siberia in the frozen north, which have large pools of carbon trapped in the soil, are now reaching the melting temperature, and they are releasing methane and carbon dioxide, depending on how much water is present. And that can add to our load of carbon dioxide and heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, which can compound the blanketing effect of trapping in the Earth's heat.
So those are themselves greenhouse gases. So what you're saying is that the greenhouse effect is augmented by the previous greenhouse effect and by the melting that the previous emissions of greenhouse gases had already developed. So sort of a vicious cycle. Is that what you're saying?
It is, especially in the polar regions where we have, as soon as you melt some ice and expose dark ground, or you melt back sea ice and expose the darker ocean, those darker surfaces will absorb more of the sun's energy that's naturally falling on those parts of the Earth. And that is causing an amplification of warming in the Arctic. And so we see the most dramatic temperature rises in the higher latitudes.
Marvin, I also might mention that one of the things that is happening with global warming is that we're starting to have new kinds of extreme weather events that we never had before. I was at a conference in Brazil this past year, and there was a discussion of a hurricane that occurred in the South Atlantic that actually hit the coast of Brazil last year. That was the first hurricane ever in the South Atlantic.
Wasn't that Catarina?
Catarina,
yeah.
Right. And it had always been thought that the South Atlantic was simply too cold an ocean to generate hurricanes. The cold currents coming north from Antarctica simply prevent the water from getting warm enough to generate hurricanes. But now we're seeing that, you know, that's not true, and it's really unknown, you know, how much that is simply a fluke and whether that's going to be repeating itself, so that the, you know, a whole area of the world that never had to worry about cyclones before may now be vulnerable to them.
So in terms of modeling for climate change due to the greenhouse effect, are there predictions about how this is likely to affect agriculture and food supply? Are there concerns that there may be regions of the world where people may already be hungry, but people are going to even be worse off?
It's still not clear from the models of the world climate and global circulation what's going to be the effects of global warming on precipitation. We know better and better now, you know, not only that it's going to be warming up the world, but what areas are going to be warming up more, what areas, what times of year, what even times of day we're going to get the largest increases in temperature. And that definitely will affect precipitation, but it won't do it in a straightforward way. There are some places that are fairly dry that make it drier, others that make it wetter. It'll shift around where rainfall and snowfall happen. And that's got to have an effect on agriculture. There are some possibilities that could be very, very serious. And there could be some major breadbasket regions of the world that could be affected. But I would say we don't yet have good enough information from those models to be able to say with much certainty what's going to happen to precipitation and therefore to be able to make good predictions about agriculture. But it's as if we're running a giant experiment with the world's climate without really having a good idea of what it's going to do to it.
Precipitation is something that we need to improve in the global simulation of climate in the future. And it's very difficult to understand all the parameters, but we do know that if, for example, some of these regions such as California, where you have the snowpack in the Sierra Mountains, are so important for the Central Valley farming, there are indications. We do not know how much the snowpack will be accumulated or reduced depending on how the precipitation changes. However, if we continue to warm, there is a chance that the snowpack, whatever its volume, may melt earlier in the season. And if that's the case, the water resource managers in California would have to plan carefully to be able to hold on to enough water so that they can get through perhaps some of these dry summers and have enough water in the reservoirs for the high growing season in the Central Valley. And these are issues that are going to have to be carefully looked at to see how the water resources are maintained so we don't lose that precious snowpack to flooding and runoff that's released from the reservoirs too early.
Of course, these are often, these uncertainties often are about agricultural areas where there's already major conflicts about water just from the competing demands of cities, of agriculture, needs for wildlife, needs for fish, etc., as you have in the southwest of the U.S. And because we have such large populations in desert areas, and we have actually so much agriculture in desert areas, in areas that normally would be very marginal for agriculture, but because of irrigation based on snowmelt and the sources of water sometimes from hundreds of miles away, agriculture is very well developed there and is a major demand on water. And so any kind of decrease in the total amount of water or even changes in when it comes seasonally are going to have a big impact and lead to major conflicts between, for example, cities and water to drink versus farms and water to irrigate.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, our dependence here in the U.S. at least on private forms of transportation, in particular automobiles, became an issue since people who didn't own vehicles were unable to evacuate the city, and that became a big problem. Apparently the people who had vehicles were able to get out without too much difficulty. But on the other hand, you could have argued that maybe the private model is not effective either, since there was enormous difficulties with every single family or individual in their individual cars. They couldn't evacuate Houston, basically, and even though there was plenty of warning for the next hurricane, which was Hurricane Rita. So I guess one issue with transportation is what would be the best model for evacuation of areas that need to be evacuated prior to a storm. Now, I know you're not experts on that issue, but I also have this belief that you've probably given a lot of thought to that issue, both of you, because I know that both of you have been terribly concerned about greenhouse gases and climate change through your careers. So, and of course, transportation, I believe, is either nationally or worldwide, if I'm not mistaken, is responsible for about 25% of the emission of greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide. When you look at transportation, what do you see as the best solutions to transportation here in the U.S. and worldwide?
I think consumers need more choices about what they can buy when they go to the car dealership. If we had many more sporty models of cars and trucks that had significantly more gas mileage, not only would it be good for the environment, not only would it help protect our coastal residents, but also they personally would be saving a lot more money at the gas pump over the life of that car. And so that would be a big significant reduction in our heat trapping emissions, because the transportation sector, as you say, is quite large, and the United States as a whole emits a quarter of the world's heat-trapping emissions, and a large part of that is transportation.
It's also clear, and I think you alluded to this with the evacuation in advance of Hurricane Rita, that when you're trying to evacuate areas, you need mass transport. It's the time when the failure to develop good mass transit systems in the United States becomes clearest, because even if you have enough advanced warning and you have millions of people getting into their individual family cars and driving out of town, you have so many people that you get these massive traffic jams, as we saw in Texas. So when you need to get large numbers of people long distances in a short period of time, you need to have a mass transit system, and that can be of lots of different forms, railroads, buses, light rail systems, and those sorts of things, in addition to being really important in times of crisis like that, are also going to reduce the production of greenhouse gases and therefore are going to some extent, make the global warming process happen more slowly. And so you benefit sort of on both sides from that.
So just to be more specific, so what you're talking about is not just having better or even more frequent trains using existing tracks or more buses on existing tracks, but perhaps developing more lines, more transit lines, so that there would be more lines available and better ability to evacuate a large city. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, we have, for example, for our rail system, we really have a very poorly developed national rail system compared to most other countries in the world. Amtrak has been privatized, it's been underfunded. It has not been a major component of the way people travel between cities in this country, as railroads are in places like Japan or in Europe or other countries. Same thing goes for light rail systems. We have not developed those very well. We haven't, when we've developed mass transit, usually we've done it with very capital-intensive subway systems that are enormously costly and relatively inflexible. You know, once you've invested all those billions of dollars in putting the lines into the ground, you can't move them. You can't change them around easily when patterns of development change over the coming decades. So I think we need more investment in our transportation infrastructure, but we need a different kind of transportation infrastructure too.
If you're not in favor of the more intensive kind of development of railway lines, what are you really referring to in terms of light rail?
The distinction between so-called light rail and heavy rail, it's something you see in lots of different places. Light rail are things that are much more similar to what we used to call trolley lines. Above ground, Portland, for example, has a good system of light rail that goes all over the city that is very inexpensive, free in parts of the city, and that carries very large numbers of people, as opposed to putting in underground, very large investment demanding kinds of systems like some of the newer subway systems that are being put in nowadays in Los Angeles, for example, where you spend much, much more money. And, of course, you know, from the point of view of contractors and building corporations' profits, that's wonderful for them. But in terms of actually serving the needs of the city, I don't think it's nearly as good. And the same applies to intercity kinds of railroads. You know, we need more of them, but we don't need to put massive investments into just a few lines, which basically takes all the money away that could be spent in many other parts.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today include Doug Boucher and Brenda Ekwurzel, and we've been discussing natural disasters, addressing the question of whether they're in fact random acts of nature or whether human activity could actually be having a major impact on both the frequency and severity of these so-called natural events. On the second part of the show, we'll expand our look at human impacts on the environment and look at deforestation as a major aggravating factor that affects both floods and droughts, and also discuss government policies and individual actions that might start to address the problem. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we've been discussing natural disasters and the human activity that tends to make these disasters both more frequent and severe, and the likelihood that so-called natural disasters could become increasingly common over the next several decades. Our guests, Brenda Eckwurzel and Doug Boucher, are both experts in the fields of hydrology, climate science, and environmental biology. Now back to the interview.
Earlier, you spoke of some of the development that's gone on in southern Louisiana in terms of how the wetlands are being handled, and that in turn aggravating the impacts of any hurricane that might come that way. But I'd like to turn now to another way we use and impact land areas, and that has to do with how we use forests. And I was wondering if the modern society's use of forests, both here in the U.S. and in poorer countries, may be impacting, on the one hand, global warming, and on the other hand, perhaps other types of what are called natural disasters, such as droughts and flooding.
Certainly, forests are a very key component of helping to store the carbon that we have in the atmosphere. The trees are going to be storing a vast amount of carbon if we have large tracts of forests. Unfortunately, there are lots of projects throughout the world where we have massive deforestation, and that is contributing a large part of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere.
There's also a very important effect of forests in holding on to water and keeping them from being lost into streams and rivers rapidly, and making it so that the flow of streams tends to be less in times when it rains, but more and more dependable in times when it doesn't rain. So when you deforest areas, you get two negative impacts. On the one hand, you get more runoff and therefore more erosion and more flooding. And on the other hand, afterwards, you have less water that's stored in the soil, that's held in the forest, that is able to be released slowly over the subsequent days. And therefore, you tend to get longer droughts also. So deforestation really, you know, it gives us two opposite kinds of problems, both flooding and drought. For example, one of the things that New York City did a few decades ago was to sign some agreements for forest conservation in the Catskills. A major part of New York City's public water comes from reservoirs in the Catskills. And what they found was that with increasing development of houses and residential areas, vacation homes in the Catskills, that was threatening their water supply, because in fact they would get more erosion off of the hillsides and the mountains. They would get flooding, but then the reservoirs would be drying up again in subsequent dry periods. And they actually calculated that it would be considerably more advantageous from a purely financial dollars and cents point of view to pay people to keep land in forests around the landscape of Catskills rather than to build new water systems. So that they actually made out better, you know, not only in terms of conserving areas of forest, but also saving the people of New York City some money.
Drought on the one hand and flooding on the other, again, seemingly opposite types of problems, are again another type of disaster that are called natural disasters and blamed. In the case of drought, you just say, why doesn't it rain? It's not raining enough. But you're saying that deforestation may be a major contributor. And is there a model or an estimate of the importance of human activity and especially deforestation in the development of droughts, or for that matter, of flooding?
Well, the models tend to be local and regional because it depends on your particular pattern of rainfall, your particular kinds of soils, your landscape, etc. But it's been shown again and again that when you have deforestation, and particularly when you have development that paves over surfaces, what is referred to in the planning literature as impervious surfaces, that means that just about all the rain that falls immediately runs off. And it's a problem because, you know, we have to build our stormwater systems large enough to handle that, to prevent flooding. And it's also a problem because that water then is lost and is not there for our use in subsequent weeks and months. So there are lots of hydrology models of different basins, of different watersheds that actually are in use every day by land use planners, by people involved in water supply and water quality issues, that not only tell them that these negative effects are going to happen, but even allow them to predict, you know, with this much impervious surface, with this much deforestation, this is how it's going to affect our water supply next year.
Now, when you're looking at human impacts on another type of natural disaster, in this case, I wanted to talk about earthquakes. Do you feel that there are human impacts on earthquake? That would strike me as one of the things that's the most natural of all these supposedly natural disasters. Like, what are we doing that might impact that?
Well, certainly an earthquake that may be hitting Mexico City or parts of Turkey may have a different damage in property damage compared to an earthquake that hits, say, the Bay Area or Los Angeles, because the different amount of investments of these countries in the building codes that can withstand shaking, or, for example, the City Hall in San Francisco right now is being retrofitted to basically be on these large rubber balls so that the structure of City Hall can shake with, quote-unquote, the big one. It's a huge amount of investment to build structures that can protect people during a large earthquake. And if you're in a region that has not invested in that or was not able to invest or has older infrastructure, then there is more likelihood for costly damage and potential loss of life.
It's also a question of us building in places that are prone to earthquake. Mm-hmm. I have worked for many years in Nicaragua, and Managua, the capital city of Nicaragua, had its entire downtown area destroyed by an earthquake in December of 1972. And the geological studies afterwards showed that the fault line, in fact, ran right through the center of the city. And based on that, in the 1980s, under the Sandinista government, a large part of what had been the downtown area was actually turned into an enormous public park, because it was felt that it was just too risky to rebuild right there on the fault line, where the geological studies showed that the risk of an earthquake happening again was quite high. Now, unfortunately, in the last decade, a lot of that policy has been changed, and a lot of the parkland is being turned into buildings and development again, so the risk is increasing. But part of dealing with natural disasters is realizing that in many cases we can't prevent them. They will happen, and we ought to live in parts of the landscape where, when they happen, we will not be as badly damaged.
Is it the, when you look at these disasters affecting the health and the lives of so many people, do you ever think that perhaps the underlying problem here might actually be related to population, world population? For example, is there really any model for the poor countries developing that doesn't end up adding to the greenhouse effect? People in the poor countries, for example, are often criticized for cutting down trees for fuel. In many countries, people, especially women, walk miles and miles every day to cut down trees or to find wood so they can cook. And then in the Amazon, I know that people are cutting down and burning down the Amazon because they're desperate to find land. But the reality is that these people are very poor, and as I said, much of the time they're quite desperate. And you can criticize them, but on the other hand, doesn't the average person in the wealthy countries directly or indirectly even consume much more fuel than those people who are often characterized as being irresponsible? So I guess what I'm getting at, and as you mentioned, with only 4% of the world's population, we in the U.S. are accounting for a quarter of the greenhouse gas problem. I know that other developed nations are a little better than that, but is there really, is there really a model of development currently that would really allow all 7 or so billion people in the world to live comfortably?
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible from a technological point of view. We have lots of alternative ways of using energy so as to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas production. We can use it, for example, for mass transit rather than for more and more individual vehicles. We can use it for higher mileage vehicles so that, you know, we spend half as much on basically getting from our house to our work and back every day, half as much in terms of gases, the gas we consume, half as much in terms of what we pay, and half as much in terms of what we actually contribute to the greenhouse warming problem. But I think it's also, you know, to some extent a question of deciding what are the real important things that we ought to be using fossil fuels for, so that, for example, should poor people be able to use it in third world countries as an alternative to firewood for cooking? Is that a more important thing from the point of view of human welfare than using it to drive SUVs that get 12 miles per gallon? You can have an alternative that gets two or three times that mileage. And of course, in the longer run, it's a question of replacing the fossil fuel uses with alternatives that are renewable, with solar energy, with wind energy, with tidal and geothermal kinds of energy, and using electricity generated from those sources to replace a lot of the things that right now we burn fossil fuels for.
In general, all the resources are strained with a growing population of the planet, and there's no way we can escape that. The per capita consumption of energy in the United States is incredibly large, and we are having an incredible impact on the planet as far as the heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. If we were to continue business as usual, and many developing nations were to want to reach the similar lifestyle of Western nations, the world would have severe strain on its resources. The only way we can move forward responsibly is to try to build a sustainable resource, renewable resource intensive economy rather than consumptive resources that we are just consuming and are not for mining our groundwater and mining our coal and oil and burning them up and throwing it up into the atmosphere.
And in fact, some of the alternatives are probably even better suited to third world kind of situations than they are to the rich countries. For example, solar energy is a much better option in tropical countries where you have a lot of sunlight year-round than it is in places where you have, in the winter, you know, short day lengths and the sun at a very low angle. So in many ways, you can actually incorporate these things into development and have them be even more efficient and productive than they are in use in rich countries.
But it strikes me that what you're asking the developed countries, especially the U.S., to do is really something they're not doing. You were just suggesting that the U.S. work on developing solar energy, because clearly the poorest countries in the world don't have the scientific expertise to really come up with ways to actually use alternative energy such as solar. They're not about to develop the best photovoltaic cell in a country that can hardly feed its people. So I'm also bringing up that we need to be role models, that to some extent the wealthy nations end up being role models. And we're also not, as a role model in this area, I would guess that you would view us as being very poor, a very poor role model for the poor countries. So I guess the question is, it seems to me that you're looking for very major policy changes in what the wealthy nations are doing. And so I'd like to finish up the interview by focusing on policy, both in government, in the wealthy nations, especially the U.S., and also what you would like to see the private sector do.
Certainly, I believe that many multinational corporations are already taking steps and showing leadership, not all of them. But for example, DuPont has reported earnings of $2 billion in savings after investing $57 million in trying to reduce their heat-trapping gas emissions and increasing their energy efficiency of processes across their company. And they characterize it as the gift that keeps on giving. And with these leaders who are showing the way, I think other businesses will also see that it makes economic sense to increase their energy efficiency, and they can be role models for many other businesses, especially as these businesses become more competitive in the marketplace. And secondly, as far as global warming and reducing heat trapping emissions, it certainly is going to take everyone's effort, from consumers who hopefully will have more choices when they go to buy products and energy efficient appliances, but all the way through local, state, and especially federal levels of government, where policy is enacted nationwide with tax incentives for renewable energy standards and for higher fuel efficiency. So a car company is not producing different cars for California compared to the rest of the nation, but all the nation, everyone has higher fuel-efficient cars.
It's also important to realize that although these seem like major policy changes from the point of view of the U.S., and particularly the current administration, they're really things that are already being implemented in many other countries that are just as rich as we are, have just as high or a higher standard of living than we do. And so they're the sorts of changes, pushing renewables, pushing conservation, for example, government purchases on a large scale to bring down the costs of some of these technologies, that can be done without major changes in the way that we live and in the standard of living. What it takes is the political will to actually do it.
Yeah, these smart solutions exist now, and we don't have to wait for some elusive technologies in the future. We can start now, and we just really, as you say, we need the resolve to see them through.
Did you feel that the Kyoto Accord was an important first step? Was that a place to start, or what were your thoughts on that?
I think it was an important first step, but one of the things to realize is how much hasn't been done since then. Kyoto was really negotiated in the early 90s and signed in the mid-90s, and was supposed to return our emissions of greenhouse gases by the year 2010 to the same level as in 1990. Not even reduce it, but merely have it go up and then come back down again to the same level as 1990. Well, we're getting pretty close to 2010, and we haven't come close to complying with that. And of course, the U.S. is the worst offender in that. We haven't even been willing to ratify the treaty, and we have a government and administration that basically is opposed to any major action on it. So it is clearly something that was important, because at least the world started to work on global warming, but what has been done so far is very, very inadequate.
Well, I think that there are some clear messages being sent from state legislatures to the national level and the local mayors. There was recently an initiative by the mayor of Seattle and many mayors, about 170 around the nation, decided to sign a Kyoto-like agreement to say locally, if Kyoto were signed, what would we have to do locally to meet those requirements? And Mayor Nagin of New Orleans, when he signed it, he said, as a city, we are the most vulnerable to the impacts of global warming, and he signed the agreement to start taking the steps.
And this was well before the hurricane.
Well before the hurricane, and unfortunately, I think it's a good analogy, because we really cannot delay. The cost of inaction just keeps growing with each year, and we really have to start implementing these measures that we know about and invest in R&D that can help find the new alternative renewable clean energy sources of the future.
So, and on an issue that is of such immense global scale, affecting public health in disasters repeatedly across the globe, and having even somewhat graver implications for the future, at the same time as our government doesn't seem to be implementing policies that are going to help anything, it's to the contrary. What would you like to see the average listener do?
Well, it would be great to vote with their dollar whenever they do make big purchases for more energy efficient appliances and more fuel economy vehicles, but of course we really need more choices for consumers so they can make that vote. It really is individuals, that's a difficult proposition if you don't have many models on the shop floor in the dealership. And certainly we need leadership at all levels of government to show that this makes economic sense and can be great for the economy of the United States. But on a longer-term view of our impact in the world is essential every time we go and decide to drive 55 miles an hour versus 75. Certainly the wind resistance between 50 and 70 increases dramatically and lowers our fuel efficiency of the car. And we have to pay more the next time we fill up our car when we've been driving over 70 miles an hour.
I think you need a combination of individual kinds of efforts as consumers and collective efforts as citizens. You know, you have to vote with your dollars and you also have to vote with your votes. It takes pressure on the political system. It takes pressure on companies, all kinds, whether it's demonstrations and boycotts and marches and throwing people out of office because they lose elections because they're not willing to face up to problems of energy conservation and global warming. And in addition, individually, you know, choosing to drive more slowly and use alternative energy sources and hybrid vehicles and things like that. It really does take both.
So for listeners who would like to learn more about the relationship between human activity and, quote, natural disasters, can you direct listeners to websites where they might learn more?
One is the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is UCSUSA.org. And you can find solutions on that website.
I might mention also, part of what you need to do is just to look at the daily newspaper and TV programs with a different sort of eye. You know, all these sorts of pieces of news that you get that talk about natural disasters that make it seem that it was fatalistic, it was God's will, it, you know, we couldn't do anything to prevent it. Look at all that information and start asking yourself, well, why were people in danger? Why did we build in those areas? What is it that we've been doing to our climate make the area much more vulnerable? And so it's not so much specialized information that you need as simply looking at the information you get from a different point of view.
Well, Doug Boucher and Brenda Eck-Wurzel, I'd like to thank you both so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.